Welcome to the NZ Everyday Investor This Week. Alphabet Soup, DTR, CFR, GFC, OCR, RBNZ, and finally CBDCs. That's what's swimming in our soup today, and that's what we're going to be talking about. This isn't a beginner's episode, but it's also not for the advanced. It's probably somewhere in between. And I think when you're trying to learn about investing, sometimes you need things broken down into three easy steps so that it really gives your brain a chance to understand what you're hearing. But other times, if you've mastered a simple concept around investing, like say compound returns, where your investment gains are made from your investment gains, you may start to feel a little bit hungrier eventually for deeper understanding. Now, personally, I flip-flop all the time between what may be considered pretty basic concepts to things that are way out of my depth. So who's my guest? Well, Jared Kerr is my guest. Now, Jared is the chief economist at KiwiBank, and we're going to talk today about an alphabet soup that contains a bunch of three or four letter acronyms. Now, this is going to be the frame that we're going to use to have a broader discussion about all things that sit around the intersection between monetary policy and the real economy. You know, that thing where you and I hang out? Well, if you own property or you want to own property or you're in business or you're employed by a business, pretty much everybody, you're going to enjoy this one today because it's going to help interpret some of the signs out there that indicate some pretty significant changes may be afoot. Now, hey, just a quick thank you also for all of those who put a vote into the NZ Podcast Awards recently. Those that are on the newsletter probably would have seen a call to action there, and quite a few of you must have jumped in there. So I'm not sure if I talked about it on the podcast or not. But yeah, I can't believe it. We've got the Silver Award in the Best Business Podcast. So thanks again for listening in, and especially thank you to those who took the time to put a vote in. Really appreciate that. It's pretty cool to see how more people are really enjoying this sort of stuff lately. And also, I just know that hopefully somebody's getting some benefit out of these discussions. So now gold, if you were wondering, was given to the Business is Boring podcast. So there you go. If you haven't listened to that, and I haven't listened to it myself, perhaps that could be another one to add to your list if you haven't discovered them yet also. Anyway, who wants to start this discussion today? Well, I do. Let's make a start. The NZ Everyday Investor Podcast, a podcast series designed to help you, the everyday Kiwi, build new wealth in the new world that we're heading into. My name's Darcy Ungaro. I'm your host and qualified financial advisor. Managed funds, property, shares, crypto. Whether you're investing for your retirement or saving for your first home, I explore anything and everything, mainstream or alternative, that can help you on your way. If you're into thinking for yourself and you have a desire to grow wealth, then you've come to the right place. Extra insights and information on today's show can be found by tapping or swiping over the cover art in your podcast player. Here you'll find some show notes, which will contain all relevant links related to today's topic. While you're there, be sure to sign up to the newsletter and follow the show across all social media channels, including YouTube. Investment options and strategies discussed on the show may not be suitable for all investors. Please be sure to conduct plenty of your own independent research and ideally obtain advice before acting on anything discussed. Hope you enjoy the show. Jared Kerr, Chief Economist with KiwiBank. How are you?
Good. How are you, Darcy?
Very good. Well, thank you for joining me today. I'd like to just go through a little bit of an alphabet soup of sorts and have a bit of a discussion around a couple of three-letter, four-letter acronyms as we go. DTI, CFR, GFC, OCR, RBNZ, and then we'll finish up with a bit of CBDCs. How does that sound?
Sounds good.
Okay. Awesome. Well, the first one, the first cab off the rank, DTIs, debt to income ratios. What are they and what are they designed to do?
Debt to income ratio is trying to limit the amount of debt that people can take on compared to the income that they earn. And the main target is your leveraged investor. So with the housing market going as gangbusters as ours, and with the participation of investors, the Reserve Bank has come out guns blazing, wanting to try and restrain investor activity. But DTIs would also have an adverse impact on first home buyers. So I wouldn't be surprised if first home buyers are exempt from the DTIs, but focus is very much on investors, and investors beware. You know, as of, I think, in the next 6 to 12 months, we could have DTIs fully implemented, and that'll restrict the amount of leverage that can go into the system.
And it's not like it's a new concept, is it? Like, you know, last year, Adrian Orr from the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, he wanted to introduce it in June. Government gave him an in principle approval to use it, but it's already kind of informally, or it already has been informally in use by the banks anyway, with how they stress test their mortgages. So why does it actually have to come from the Reserve Bank when really the banks are kind of already doing it anyway?
Well, you're right. It's about, I guess, putting in a standard that the Reserve Bank thinks needs to be, you know, adhered to. Like you say, banks do a whole range of tests on applicants as they come through for mortgages, and we're obviously assessing how much debt can be serviced and how much debt is reasonable to take on. But these guidelines, if you like, can be made stricter in periods like we're going through right now, where housing market has seen some unsustainable gains.
Okay. And I guess the whole idea is that once it's in place from the Reserve Banks, and at least they've got a conduit, like a direct line into bank lending policy, which they could adjust up or down if they required that intervention, right?
Yeah, exactly right. You can tighten things up when the market's hot, and you can ease things back when the market cools off. It's just another tool in their toolkit. It's something the Reserve Bank's been asking for a while now. I think they've been asking for it for over 5 years. So the fact that they've got it now and potentially bring it through is just another tool in that toolbox to try and rein in this rampant housing market.
Now, I'm just reading something, and I'll put a link in the show notes to this press release. I guess it's a press release from the Reserve Bank of New Zealand from the 3rd of November, where Adrian Orr says that we also intend to increase the minimum core funding ratio, the CFR, the minimum core funding ratio requirements, to its previous level of 75% on the 1st of January 2022, subject to no significant worsening in economic conditions. So what the heck is a CFR?
Yeah, well, I have a vague idea. So our core funding ratio is, as you say, previously set at 75%. So of all the bank's assets, its mortgages, we have to hold 75% of core funding. And core funding is something that is considered stable and generally over 1 year in maturity. So we've got plenty of liquid assets for the assets that we have on our balance sheet. Banks basically need to have enough money to make sure that we can run effectively and people don't lose faith in the banking system.
And that's often what it is, isn't it? It's faith, because when you look at some of the mechanics, it kind of seems somewhat arbitrary, these levers and these mechanisms and these flows of money. You kind of think, well, why do they even need to do that? But it really is kind of about faith, isn't it?
It's all about faith. Absolutely. You lose trust in the banking system and you get run on banks. You get runs on banks like we've seen, you know, 100 years ago, and banks can collapse. The idea of all of these rules today is to make sure the banks have enough liquidity so that they don't collapse. The reason why the central bank dropped the core funding ratio from 75 down to 50 was in the height of the pandemic. Last year, financial markets started to dislocate and access to funding started to evaporate. So the bank got concerned and said, well, you know, you can reduce your reliance on long-term wholesale funding for a period. And, you know, we'll see how we go through this crisis. As it turned out, deposits and banks actually lifted quite materially last year. And I don't think any bank went down towards 50%. I think most banks stayed around that 75% level anyway.
They thought one thing was going to happen, and so they kind of loosened up the reins in a lot of areas. But in reality, the opposite thing happened, and then they actually contributed to potentially some of the side effects because they didn't readjust fast enough, right?
Yeah, I mean, there was a period there of about a month where we thought this was going to end up being a financial market event. You know, financial markets were seizing. It looked like 2008. There were some signs there of what we saw at the start of the 2008 crisis. So the central bank, you know, correctly pulled out all stops and slashed interest rates and made it easier for banks. And as it turned out, only sort of 6 months later, we were bouncing back and things didn't get anywhere near as bad as expected.
Mm. Do you think they kind of kept a little bit loose for a bit too long, or do you think they kind of reined it in at just the right time?
I think in hindsight, but the counterfactual is also true. You know, had they not done all of these things, we may be in a very different place today. So I think the fact that they pulled out all the stops made sure that we recovered quite quickly. And now they're in the process of normalizing policy. So, you know, that CFR has been brought back to 75%, even though we never really used it. Interest rates have been lifted, LVR restrictions have been put back on, and now we're talking about DTI. So, you know, we've gone from making everything really easy to now making things tighter.
Good cop, bad cop. Cool.
Yeah.
Let's flip on over to another three-letter acronym, TLA. The OCR, the official cash rate. I want to talk now about the relationship between the official cash rate and fixed interest rates, what the majority of Kiwis actually consume. It's a fixed rate mortgage.
Yeah.
Are we looking at the wrong reference point potentially with mortgage rates? Often we fixate on when these OCR announcements are, or the MPS, the monetary policy statements, we fixate on that. Yet we've seen a 0.25% increase in the OCR, yet we've seen almost like 1.8% increase on the fixed interest rates. So have any of the mechanics around how banks set interest rates changed since the GFC, the global financial crisis?
No, but like you say, we focus very much on the OCR, which is an overnight cash rate for banks. And where banks deal with mortgages is actually around the 1 to 3 year part of the swap curve, which is much higher than where the cash rate is. And you're right. So we've had a 25 basis point increase in the cash rate, and yet mortgage rates and savings rates have increased, you know, over 1%. What's changed is the central bank has told us, well, actually, we've lifted the cash rate 25 basis points, but we're expecting to lift it another 200 basis points over the next 2 years. So another 2% of OCR hikes coming through. So when you think of two-year money is taking into account all of those increases over the next 2 years. And that's why we've seen those 1, 2, 3, 5 year interest rates increase quite dramatically. So you'll remember savings rates, we had term deposit rates of less than 1%. Now you get a 1 year term deposit rate of 2% and a 2 year term deposit rate of 2.5%. And that then where we get our funding, you then got to think about, well, where's mortgage rates on top of that? Well, they're now closer to 4 rather than 2.5. So everything's shifted higher on expectations of OCR hikes over the next 2 years.
Okay. So it's kind of like,
I hope that explains it.
Yeah, sort of. So it's kind of like, so fixed rates are kind of like a function of the expectation of where the OCR is going to be in some point in the future, right?
Bang on. Yeah, okay. Absolutely. So a 2 year rate has to take into account all the increases or decreases in a cash rate over that period.
Okay, that's cool. Like, I'm just thinking in terms of how the banks source their money. So one of the ways, I guess, you can look at how the banks work in terms of lending, whether or not it's entirely correct or not, is that, you know, they've got a pot of money that they can get over here or a pot of money that they can get over here. And one of those pots being all the money that we've been dumping into our savings account, building up our cash reserves, must surely be an incredibly cheap source of funding for the banks, because they're willing to accept probably very, very low rates of return on those deposits with the bank. So do you see that it's possible that the bank profits will actually start to increase significantly from here as a result in a rising interest rate environment?
I don't see profitability increasing dramatically from here. What we've seen is it's actually quite difficult to attract term deposits at such low interest rates, and we need term deposits. So I've seen term deposit rates increase quite dramatically in the last 6 months as we try to attract more money into the banks. So we're paying up for term deposits at the same time we're offering mortgage rates on the other hand. The difference between the two, the net interest margin is relatively stable. So no, we're not actually gaining a lot of profitability here.
So there's no real underlying incentive for the banks to necessarily increase interest rates independently of where the OCR predictions are going, right?
Oh, there are, and we have. So we've increased our savings rates and our mortgage rates, as you say, by a lot more than what the OCR has done. And that's in anticipation of the extra moves that we see coming through over the next year. So we have done out of cycle changes over the last few months in particular on both mortgage carded rates and term deposit rates. Okay. One thing I'll be interested in is we've noticed that as interest rates fell and as term deposit rates fell below 2%, we noticed people took their money out of term deposit rates and just put it onto transactional accounts. Now I'm wondering whether we'll see that money go out of transactional accounts and back out into term deposit rates now that there's actually a decent yield of over 2%.
Yeah, it's interesting seeing this whole path to normalization. It doesn't feel like a normal environment out there. It feels very abnormal still.
No, we're far from normal.
but at the same time, we're seeing little breadcrumbs that we can follow back to a normal place and higher returns. I'm just thinking about those that still cling to the notion of living off of the fruit of capital rather than capital itself, like those who are dependent on interest income to live perhaps in retirement. They now have a breath of fresh air or a second life, so to speak, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good way of putting it. Those that live on the fruit of capital, you know, they're putting their capital into the bank, getting a term deposit rate. And over the last, you know, year and a half, 2 years, they haven't received much for their money because the cash rate was slashed towards zero. And there was a threat of a negative cash rate, if you remember this time last year.
That's right.
So they got scorched. Savers got really hurt in that environment. It was great for borrowers, but savers got really hurt. And now we're in a position where interest rates are normalizing. They're going back to something more normal. So they'll get more return on their money. So those fruits will grow.
And it would be too long of a podcast for us to talk about all the ways that things are abnormal out there in terms of the economy, how things work, and just, you know, are we ever going to get back to what we knew, or do we just have to get comfortable, I guess, with the way things are going to be. Now, I want to talk about fixed rate mortgages and just the impact on households. So not necessarily on property prices, we'll go there shortly, but just in terms of typical expenses running through the household. About a year ago, a 1 year fixed rate mortgage was 2.19%. Now you're looking at almost 3.99%, right? 3.85, 3.99%. So if that was a $500,000 mortgage, actually, I just need to check that. Is that right? Yeah, it is right. That's crazy. So it just seems so wrong. I have to double check my notes here. So on a $500,000 mortgage, that's like $750 more a month just in interest. So can you see that this is going to have a massive, massive impact on the average household? And is there by default like an increasing risk of mortgage defaults coming our way?
It's definitely going to have an impact on households, absolutely. And across the economy, we've taken on more debt over the last few years compared to our income. So we're definitely more sensitive as an economy to interest rate increases. And as you say, that rate of 2.19, that was an emergency rate. That was a record low mortgage rate that we've never seen before. The lowest rates we'd seen prior to that were in the 50s, and they didn't get down, the 1950s, and they didn't get down to that level. So that was an extraordinarily low interest rate. Now that we've risen back to 3.99 or whatever the 1 year rate is at the moment, that's a more normal rate, if you like. In terms of serviceability, you know, it's definitely going to hurt those who have just taken on new mortgages and trying to get used to it. But if we've done our jobs right as banks, we've stress tested the interest rate that people can pay. So when you come in and ask for a mortgage, we make sure that you can actually pay 6% interest on your loan. So in theory, we've moved from 2.19 to 4%, say. Our serviceability test suggests that you can handle 6%. So there should be some room in there, although it's definitely going to, you know, you're going to feel the pinch.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the next part about this is that it's like, well, we talked about normalization occurring in some way as it relates to savers and higher interest rates, obviously fantastic news for them. Homeowners, especially the more recent arrivals into home ownership land, they're potentially going to struggle, especially if they just declared their expenses as a lot lower than probably what they really were. That's going to be a little bit uncomfortable for a group of Kiwis out there, I suspect. But going back to where interest rates might be going, not just in the next 6 months, but in maybe like the 1 to 3 year band, do you think that all the noise, all the signaling coming out of the Reserve Bank of New Zealand is more of a show of force? You know, like, hey, we can actually do this, or is it a proper sign of things to come? Like, have we properly done a reversal and we're now back up a steep incline in increasing interest rates?
I think it's both, Darcy. I really think it's both. I think it was a show of force to start with. New Zealand was one of the first central banks globally to start tightening interest rates, which was a big move, being so far ahead of the curve when compared to, say, Australia or the United States, who are, 1, 2, maybe even 3 years away from lifting their interest rates. We're doing it now. So I think it was a show of force, and a show of force against a housing market which the government is clearly concerned about and what the central bank is clearly concerned about. So definitely a show of force. And then the other part of what you're saying is, going back to something a bit more normal. So we've had emergency settings, they've worked, the economy's doing well. I'm sure you saw the labor market report last week. That was just an incredible report, with unemployment rate down at 3.4%. That's just a remarkable recovery. So there is, I guess, scope for the central bank to think, well, on one hand, the labor market's really tight and wages are rising, and on the other hand, we've got an inflation rate at 5% heading to 6%, and we're not sure how much of that is transitory, so we better address it. That means that they're going to take the cash rate, I think, to 2% by the end of next year, and we're at 0.5% now, so that's another 1.5%, and that's what's being priced into those 2 year swap rates and 2 year mortgage rates and term deposit rates.
I kind of get it, and I know what the answer to this is, but just understanding this mechanically is really hard. But just in the concept of inflation, right? When the OCR increases, when the Reserve Bank is trying to pull down inflation by taking a bit of the heat out of the market, especially when we have low unemployment, very high asset valuations, rising costs, increase the interest rate, that somehow brings inflation under control. I kind of get it because that's what I've been taught, but just kind of thinking about this critically again, from the perspective of somebody who now has what did I say before? $750 more per month as an interest bill. They're now working. The interest rate's gone up. They need to find another $750 per month. They're going to put some pressure on their employer, hopefully, to get a pay rise to cover their rising costs. How is that not inflationary? I still don't get how rising the OCR and following the money, how that doesn't actually cause the inflation that it's trying to bring down.
Well, that's the risk, and we're starting to see some pretty serious negotiations happening around the table in the labour market at the moment, because the labour market is so tight that you've got a 3.4% unemployment rate, which is well through estimates of full employment, and on the other hand, the employee is looking at their costs of living and the CPI report saying, well, inflation's running at 5%. I want at least a 5% pay rise. And in some industries, particularly construction, we're seeing some really hefty pay rises coming through. And that's why we talk about short-term impacts of inflation and, the medium-term impacts. And the short-term impacts, oil and food prices and spikes in transport costs, shipping costs, etc., we hope fade. But then there's this potential for the medium term, more sticky inflation coming through via wages, which is where they get a little bit concerned. So what they want to do is take some of the heat out, particularly in housing, because a lot of the inflation we're seeing domestically is being generated around housing. But like you say, taking some of the discretionary income out of people's back pockets, it's a harsh job. And it's one that the central bank takes quite seriously and being worried about medium-term inflation forces.
Interesting. So now going back to just the impacts of that, you know, rising interest rates again, I've been a little bit out there in the last week, I guess, around speculating that the property market could hit a bit of a downturn next year. And from my perspective, almost everything on that theory rests on interest rates. And I did a poll on LinkedIn and it was like, interesting, right? So I suspect I'm probably well and truly alone here, but what are your thoughts on where the property market might be going next year? And why do you think that?
I'm probably leaning more towards your camp, Darcy. I think we're going to see my camp, Jared.
It's nice to have some visitors.
We're probably going to see a housing market which is very subdued next year. So I think there's a number of forces at play here. We've already talked about DTIs, LVR restrictions, interest deductibility being removed, a real focus on investors. But then, as you say, interest rates are increasing, and that has an impact on people's ability to borrow and willingness to borrow and service debt. So with all of these things coming onto the housing market, and more importantly, the supply of homes coming onto market surging, I think we'll have a much more balanced housing market this time next year. And we're forecasting pretty much 0 to 1% gain by this time next year. So we've had a 30% gain in prices. They've shunted up, and then we see them flattening over coming years.
That would certainly be a good outcome if it was a nice soft landing, right? But how the heck can you engineer a landing like that, right?
Absolutely. And there's a real chance we get a small correction. There is a real chance we see house prices fall. But don't forget, they've risen 30-odd% in the last year alone. So having a small dip later next year or into 2023 is not the end of the world.
Yeah, that's good. Now, something completely different. I believe that the pace of change is totally changing out there almost everywhere you look. And I had the Reserve Bank of New Zealand on the show about 6 weeks ago, which was, I guess, something akin to Mark Zuckerberg discussing the metaverse in many ways, but CBDCs, coming from the perspective of being able to influence the economy so surgically, like so much more surgically going forward, what are your thoughts on central bank issued digital currencies?
I think they're definitely coming. I think there is a demand there for cryptocurrencies and that sort of technology, that sort of currency. So I definitely think it's just a matter of time before we see a Reserve Bank issued cryptocurrency. And for me, it provides that bit of backing, that trust that is somewhat lacking in a Bitcoin or a Dogecoin. And I think it would be, you know, taken up more by business and households. It just has that backing of the central bank, which for me is quite ironic, because the whole point of cryptocurrencies was not having that backing and not being linked to a fiat currency. But this, I think, might be a medium at which, you know, some of the larger businesses can play in.
Yeah, awesome. No, that's cool. Like, it'll be interesting to watch that one play out, that's for sure. Cool. Well, that's all we have time for. Jared, thanks very much for sharing on the NZ Everyday Investor again. Now, if people want to find more about what you guys are up to and the content that you're putting out, where can we direct people to?
Well, please check us out on Twitter at Kiwi Economics.
Awesome. All right, Jared, well, you enjoy the rest of your day.
Yeah, you too. Cheers.
Cool. Take care. Thanks for listening into the NZ Everyday Investor Podcast, a show that's about helping you, the everyday Kiwi, build wealth. To learn more about the show, please visit nzeverydayinvestor.com or visit your show notes on your podcast player. There, you can find out how to make contact, sign up to our newsletter, and check out previous episodes. We're on a mission to increase wealth for everyday Kiwis. If you'd like to support what we do, then there's a few things that you can do. Write a review on whatever platform you're listening to this on. Share episodes with your friends, or support us financially on Patreon. Before we finish up, just another reminder that what was discussed today is for educational purposes only. Ideally, before acting on anything covered here, please contact your trusted financial advisor or do your own research. Hope you enjoyed today's episode, and we'll catch you next time around.